Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Most of us know the famous New England poets like Edgar Allan Poe and Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, but many of the poets who preceded them were anonymous. In fact, there was a strong culture of anonymous poets, especially in Boston, and their writings provide a unique glimpse into what life was like in Boston at the start of the 19th century. Here's a short, kind of funny one that I'm going to read, okay? You're waiting for me here, Paul? A man who saw his son quite handy toss off a glass of strong French brandy. "Nettie," cried he, "ah, don't do so, for liquor is our greatest foe." "But we are taught to love our foes," quoth Net. "So, father, here it goes." Paul Lewis is in the studio with me. He's an English professor at Boston College, and he collected some of these poems. He's also editor of the new book that's out today called The Citizen Poets of Boston, a collection of forgotten poems, 1789 to 1820. Paul, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much, Deb.
First, describe this culture of anonymous poetry in Boston right at the start of the 19th century. It sounds like it was really fascinating.
Well, difficult it is to make money as a poet today, it was essentially impossible in this period, and so people published anonymously. They weren't concerned with building their brands or marketing themselves.
Or tweeting.
They were almost no tweeting. And so people would publish poems. They'd send them off to the editor. The editor would either publish it or not, and then someone would read a poem and respond to it. It was a very interactive, intimate culture. Boston is a small place. 18,000 people at the start of this period, about 40 at the end of it.
So, and there were dozens of magazines that would do this, right? And
yes. During this 30-year period, we looked at poems in about 59 magazines.
59 magazines, just in Boston?
Yes. Well, they came and they went. Some of them were very short-lived. Others lasted for 7 or 8 years.
And was it something that sort of everyone read? And it was very, you know, if your poem was published, it was widely read by lots of folks in the community?
I suspect that widely read would be probably an overstatement. Many people were reading these magazines, but they weren't profitable enough, so I don't know about widely.
So who was reading them?
Well, I think there was a small group of people who were literate and focused on these magazines and would pick them up. The magazine, of course, the term magazine is a bit of a stretch because these were hybrid publications, half newspaper, half magazine. They would have death notices, they'd have marriage notices, they'd have tide charts, essays, all different kinds of genre news, politics, and some poetry.
So what do you think we can learn from this poetry and about what was going on at the time and what folks were like at that time as well?
The poems open doorways into the culture of Boston in this period in a way that other kinds of works perhaps don't, because they are so informal. I think of these as folk poems mostly, not professional poetry. And they have all the charm of folk art, which really brings us into the places where people were living their lives, their professions, the relationships within the family, aspirations about marriage, concerns about death. There are a lot of puzzle poems. There's a section of poems that are riddles and rebuses where one writer would send in a puzzle that had to be solved and readers would send in solutions in the form of puzzles as well, in the form of poems.
And it's my understanding that there is actually a couple of puzzles that you have not found the answers to. Is that right?
Yes. Well, what would happen was these puzzle poems were called rebuses, and they provided clues in the form of poems, and then readers would write a poem that was a solution to the rebus, and in most cases, there would be solutions that would be published in the next issue. But in some cases, the magazine went out of business, or the rebus was just too hard and nobody sent in a solution. So we call those orphan rebuses, and we've worked on them trying to solve them because in solving them, you sort of put yourself back into that frame of mind.
Well, I do want to say that I'm told by our producers that we do have an unsolved rebus on our website at radioboston.org. So anyone listening, try your hand at solving this puzzle and tweet or email us your answer. We are now in this century, but I'm wondering, just tell me, where did you find these poems, and you had your students really help you? Describe the process of gathering all of these together in a book.
Yes, I'm happy to. So these poems were not widely available to modern critics and scholars in easy-to-search format until they were digitized and put online, or put online as a collection of PDFs. And now we can read all of these magazines online. We can search them by year, date range, keyword, genre. So it's possible to find all of these poems, and then you can go through them. Most of the poems published at this time were actually copied from British magazines. And so the task becomes, how do you find the ones that are local to Boston? Mm. And we worked hard at that, and I think for the most part succeeded.
Hmm. How did you authenticate whether they were from Boston? These are anonymous poems, right? Sometimes talking about universal subjects.
Yes. Well, and as I say, we even included some we knew had been published before in England because they were so interesting that someone could have decided to republish them here. Sometimes they're outrageous or provocative, not what you'd think of. You're getting pretty deep into the weeds of internet searches with your question about how we did it. But if you enclose a quotation within, you know, if you put it in quotation marks and do a Google search, you probably will come up with the other places where that line or sentence has appeared if it's made it onto
right.
the web.
I'm actually more concerned about editorially what you wanted these poems to show.
Good. Okay. So we were really looking for poems that brought the felt life of Boston back to us, that were provided sort of buckboard time machines into life at that period and into family life, into commercial life, into the streets and places of Boston. So many poems refer to Boston Neck and Beacon Hill and the Boston Common and different streets. So you get the Liberty Tree, and you get a sense of just the way people were living and what they cared about, what sort of got them up in the morning and put them to bed at night.
And so, of course, I'd like you to read some of them. And to so you start the book with a poem that's titled The Stagecoach, right? This was published in Massachusetts Magazine in 1796.
Yeah, the office is right on Washington Street in sort of downtown Crossing area. Then that part of Washington Street had another name. It was Newbury Street, which they moved, you know where. but anyway, yes, this poem, The Stagecoach, inscribed to Myra, is the first poem in the book, and it's in a section of poems about coming to Boston. It tells the story of a young man who leaves Auburn, Massachusetts, way off in the country, 40 miles from
away,
here.
Right?
Yes, and he begins this journey in the middle of the night, and it starts like this. How first I rural bliss resigned, left Myra and my heart behind, and how, like fortune's football tossed on, I quick was tumbled into Boston. I sing, dear maid, in doggerel rhyme and numbers as the theme sublime. And you get a sense there of the modesty of this poet. It's doggerel. It's not great verse. But in fact, the story he tells is so lively and animated. He gets onto the carriage. It bounces off towards Boston. Other passengers get on. They get off. They stop at taverns. They have meals that are lavishly described, drink. And he arrives finally in Boston after this long, long journey. He's exhausted. He's already overwhelmed. The city is so noisy. Well, there might be 20,000 people living there. It's so cluttered. Carriages, noise. He goes to sleep in an inn. He's just like, nostalgic already for his life in the country. He wakes up the next morning, and he's ready to live life. I'll just finish the quote. When morn arose with smiles so pretty, I mingled with the bustling city, resolved whatever be my fate, let the world love or let it hate, let me bachelor or married or in a coach or cart be carried, or rich or poor or grave or mellow, to live or die a clever fellow.
Well, you know, it does seem almost as if, I mean, it's like poetry is entertainment, right? I mean, folks are writing about their experiences and they're publishing them and they're submitting puzzles. Was this really a form of entertainment for a lot of people?
Entertaining and interactive. So writers who talk about these magazines, critics who talk about these magazines in the period, talk about how interactive they were and how hybrid the genres are. There'd be a poem inside an essay, all of that. And I do think of it as being kind of like the early version of the web, these magazines, in the play between readers, editors, and writers, which was ongoing. I should just say in terms of entertaining that a lot of the poems are funny, and we've kind of picked some that are, but a lot of them are very serious, too. So there's people dealing with the loss of a child who's died, or, you know, a husband who's abusive. There's that poem you started out with where drinking is kind of made light of, and then there's poems about husbands who beat their wives because they drink too much. There's a poem that does that. So an early temperance work.
You know, we also have one. It's a poem titled Lines Written by a Lady Who Was Questioned Respecting Her Inclination to Marry. This was also in Massachusetts Magazine in 1794.
Yes, it was published right after the French Revolution ended, the Reign of Terror had ended, and it's actually a poem that picks up on the revolutionary zeal to make the case for women as not being bound in marriage. It's probably the most radical feminist statement of the 1790s. I'll read you part of it.
Absolutely.
With a heart light as cork, and a mind free as air, unshackled I'll live, and I'll die, I declare. No ties shall perplex me, no fetters shall bind that innocent freedom that dwells in my mind. At liberty's spring such draughts I've imbibed, I hate all the doctrines by wedlock prescribed. Its laws of obedience could never suit me. My spirit's too lofty, my thoughts are too free. And it ends, round freedom's fair standard I've rallied and paid a vow of allegiance to die an old maid. Long live the republic of freedom and ease. May its subjects live happy and do as they please.
Woof! very nicely read,
thanks.
I would like to say as well. So there really is an awful lot going on here. And I think it's really interesting that you say, you compare it to the current web, if you will. But what does it say, and we just have about a minute left here, about what Bostoners overall felt about literature and poetry?
Well, I think their taste would have run in their reading outside these magazines to mostly British poetry. They would have liked Walter Scott. They would have read Shakespeare and enjoyed Shakespeare on the stage once the theater opened a little into the 1790s here in Boston. They would have been mostly reading contemporary stuff imported, but when they turned to their own and they would have found a lot of that in their own magazines, but also these now recovered Boston poems.
All right. Paul Lewis, professor of English at Boston College and editor of the book The Citizen Poets of Boston, a collection of forgotten poems, 1789 to 1820. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And listeners, don't forget about that unsolved rebus on our website at radioboston.org. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston. Thank you.